the headlines, Israeli forces kill one Palestinian and injure dozens more in fresh raids on cities and villages in the occupied West Bank. Russian natural gas continues to flow into Europe, but energy prices on the continent are rising amid Russia's threat to cut off supplies unless they are paid in rubles. Plus, Eurozone inflation soars to another record high amid concerns over energy prices and disruptions across the continent due to the Ukraine conflict. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian in the West Bank city of Al-Khalil amid growing anti-regime anger across the occupied territories. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the man hit with live ammunition earlier. The Israeli forces also violently attacked two Palestinian villages in the south and east of Nablus. The Palestinian Red Crescent says over 130 people were injured during the Israeli raids. Also on Friday, they shot and injured two Palestinian youth in a village near the city of Ramallah. The regime's forces have intensified their attacks against Palestinians following recent deadly shooting incidents. Palestinian resistance movements, the Islamic Jihad, and Hamas have condemned the Israeli violence and killings, warning that these actions will not go unanswered. Mona Kandil joins us now from Ramallah with more on the latest Israeli violence against Palestinians in Al-Khalil. Mona, what details do you have to share with us?
Well, yes, there was a demonstration in Shuhada Street in Al-Khalil, south occupied West Bank. Palestinians throw stones because Israeli forces used live rounds. And rubber coated bullets. A number of Palestinians were wounded. 28-year-old Ahmed Al-Atrash was seriously wounded and then succumbed to his injuries. We have to mention that Al-Atrash was a Palestinian prisoner. He spent 8 years in Israeli jails. The Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs, of course, denounced the killing in cold blood of this Palestinian, because Palestinians were taking part in a peaceful demonstration against the Israeli practices in Al-Khalil and mainly in the Shuhada Street, because the Israeli settlers continue to attack Palestinians there, prevent them to move freely in Shuhada Street because of the numerous Israeli settlements. As you have mentioned also, there was another clashes took place this time in the town of Beita, mainly in the Sbeh mountain. As every Friday, Palestinians took part in an anti-settlement demonstration. There, Israeli forces attacked the peaceful protesters. According to Palestinian paramedics, we are speaking about almost 130 Palestinians were wounded. Many of them suffered from injuries because of the rubber-coated bullets. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, also protests took place against the Israeli settlement and the Israeli separation wall. But also we have to mention that there were calls from the Palestinian resistance groups on the Palestinians to respond and not to remain silent for the killing of Palestinians. We have to mention the killing of two Palestinians in Al-Khalil, in Jenin, took place yesterday, as well as in Al-Khalil. So Palestinian resistance groups have warned that in case the Israeli forces would be escalating their measures and their aggressive attacks against the Palestinians, the resistance groups would respond, and the response would be painful as well.
Thanks a lot, Mona Kandil, joining us from Ramallah. Over to news from the Ukraine conflict. It's day 37 of Russia's military offensive against Ukraine, and there has been a potential expansion of the threat of war. Russia says the conflict has for the first time spilled into its borders. Moscow has accused Kiev of carrying out an airstrike on a fuel depot in the Russian city of Belgorod It has warned that the helicopter attack could hamper peace talks. The Ukrainian foreign minister says he cannot confirm or deny the strike because he's not privy to all military information. Meanwhile, inside, Ukrainian local officials say Russian forces are withdrawing from the Chernihiv region, but have not yet left entirely. Russia had said it would cut back operations around the city as well as the capital, Kiev, in an effort to boost mutual trust in negotiations. Ukrainian officials are also reporting gains made outside Kiev and also in the southern Kherson region, but the Ukrainian president, alongside Western officials, says Russia is regrouping and preparing powerful strikes on the country's east and south. Russia's energy giant Gazprom says it's exiting from its business in Germany as Moscow's deadline passes for a switch in gas payments from euro to the ruble. The company said it had terminated its participation in Gazprom Germania and all of its assets. Berlin had reportedly threatened to expropriate Gazprom and Rosneft units in the country amid concerns over the security of energy supplies. The Kremlin said any such move would be a violation of international law. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree to impose ruble pricing for gas on buyers from unfriendly countries, including the EU, as of April the 1st. Germany, which depends on Russian gas for about 40% of its needs, rejected the request. Its economy minister said Berlin would not be, quote, blackmailed by Putin. However, the German government later said it was examining the decree to determine its specific impact. Russian natural gas is still flowing to Europe. And Eurozone inflation has soared to another record high amid concerns over energy prices and disruptions across the continent. Consumer prices in the 19 countries sharing the euro surged to 7.5% in March, which is around 1% up from the anticipated increase. That's according to Eurostat, the statistical office of the European Union. Inflation in food prices, services, and durable goods all have come in above the European Central Bank's 2% target. Experts say the soaring prices have left the ECB with a difficult policy dilemma and that any tightening policy would risk crashing the Eurozone's economy. Meanwhile, Europe is caught in an oil and gas crunch due to tensions with Russia over its military offensive in Ukraine. On this segment of the program, Iran is commemorating the 43rd anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Republic. The Iranians overwhelmingly voted in favor of the new ruling system after the collapse of the Pahlavi monarchy and the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Joining us now on this edition of the News Review, we have historian and journalist Mr. Brecht Jonkers, who's joining us from Hazelt, and also we have journalist and political analyst Mr. Elijah Magnier, who's with us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Jonkers in Hazelt. Talk to us about the significance of this day. What ripple effects did the establishment of the Islamic Republic have, both regionally and globally?
Well, I think that, of course, specifically to the area, to the region that we're talking about, the foundation of the Islamic Republic of Iran as an Islamic Republic by itself, marked a pivotal shift for the West Asian region and for the entire area that is known colloquially in the West as the Middle East, because, as indeed mentioned already, it marked the end of a highly corrupt and highly slavishly following puppet regime that of the Shah, that was and after all, somewhat of a regional powerhouse of U.S.-influenced policies, especially influenced by the U.S. Embassy and the CIA in Tehran. So the fall of this monarchy and the establishment after that, not of a liberal republic or of a liberal constitutional monarchy, but of an Islamic republic that cleaned house, let's say, and marked a complete end of what was before and returned to Islamic values, while at the same time being founded on modern democratic principles, was a very important shift and a very important blow to the United States. And not only, that is regionally, but not only regionally, but also globally, on a worldwide scale, I believe the Islamic Republic was a turning point in modern history. And a lot of the Islamic movements that we see nowadays in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, are often ideologically influenced, even if they have no direct material ties or military cooperation with Iran, they are often very ideologically influenced and ideologically inspired by the success of the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of an Islamic Republic. This is what has inspired Islamic revivalist movements across the Islamic world, for most importantly, movements such as Hezbollah in Lebanon, to basically grab this chance and grab this inspiration and to show to the world that it is perfectly possible to be an Islamic movement that is founded very fundamentally and very very loyally upon ancient religious principles, while at the same time being a movement and an organization and a project that can inspire people for the future. Prior to the Islamic Revolution, you often have this some sort of a dichotomy in the Islamic world, this difference between, on the one hand, the very obscurantist, very ultra-conservative and anti-modern movements that rejected every sort of modernity, for example, the Wahhabi movement, whereas on the other side, you had regimes such as the Shah himself being completely liberal, secular, atheist at some points, even an anti-religious, anti-non-Islamic in a way, and basically tried to be a complete copy-paste of Western liberalism of the United States and the United Kingdom. And this dichotomy between those two extremes, that both of them at the end of the day were not an alternative at all, between as an alternative to these false dichotomies that existed, came the Islamic Republic, came the Islamic Revolution, that showed that you can take the best of both worlds and build it all based on a fundamentally religious and fundamentally Islamic perspective and sure. foundation.
Let's cross over to Elijah Magni in Brussels. Let's talk about the referendum. As we know, Iranians overwhelmingly voted in favor of the new ruling system after the collapse of the Pahlavi monarchy and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Why do you think the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, insisted on having this nationwide vote? How important was it to have the full participation of the Iranian people?
Thank you for having me. I think that was a very important step in the history of the Islamic Republic when the Grand Ayatollah Khomeini decided to give the vote to the people and shifted from what the Shah represented as the ultimate authority to pass on the authority to the population and decide for themselves what kind of ruling they want. And by giving this authority to the population, this is the maxim of democracy. That's one. Two, it confirmed the protection of the population to the system they have chosen and they have selected. And that is manifested every time there are elections in Iran, when the electors vote for their representative in the parliament and their president to select the government that is going to rule the country and decide the foreign policy. And we have seen how Iran has shifted from 1979, thanks to this referendum that took place following the request of the Grand Ayatollah Khomeini to allow the people to vote. We've seen how Iran has developed itself and relied on itself, particularly under the harsh U.S. sanctions that crippled Iran for many years, and yet Iran managed to defend itself militarily, economically, and it is less relying on the West and relying more on itself. And that cannot be achieved when you live in a country where the population doesn't hold on to the system and doesn't support it. A failure to do so, the system would have collapsed a long time ago. And we've seen after 43 years, Iran not only still holding to the same system, evolving, yet getting a very important position, not only in the region, but in the entire Asia and the Middle East, where Iran is giving an example, even today to Russia, how Russia can live under harsh Western sanctions and still survive. That is the biggest example when you have the population voting for a system and supporting it.
All right, stay with us, gentlemen, as we're going to take a look at some online reactions to the news. Bonwi Javon writes, the 12th of Farvardin is one of the great festivals of history after the victory of the glorious Islamic Revolution of Iran and the Day of Pride of the Muslim nation of Iran. Etika writes, the main slogan of the revolution, independence, freedom, was the Islamic Republic, which millions of free Iranians and Muslims shouted during the struggles throughout Islamic Iran. These slogans established a government in which Islamic justice was one of its highest goals. Another user, Haj Muhammad, writes, Happy Islamic Republic of Iran Day. Today is the day of the victory of the Iranian nation against global arrogance. Today, Islamic Iran owes all its authority to Imam Khomeini, the Superman of history, and the great martyrs who sacrificed their lives for Iran. And our last user, Hassan Ashri, writes, the victory of the Islamic Republic is the victory of the idea of quote-unquote politics with religion. The nation's yes vote to the Islamic Republic was a strong no response to the trick of global colonialism. All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels, and thanks to historian and journalist Breck Jonkers speaking to us from Hasselt, Belgium. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of popular religious rule. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The 12th of Farvardin, corresponding with April 1st, has been named in Iran as the Islamic Republic Day. This day symbolizes free will and very strong role of people in the Islamic Republic system of government. We have prepared a special program on the issue. Stay tuned, please. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution on February 11, 1979, Imam Khomeini called on all Iranians to take part in a nationwide referendum to determine the ruling system after the ouster of tyrannical anti-popular system. Therefore, on the two last days of March, a referendum was held across the country in which over 98.2% of the participants voted yes to Islamic Republic as the next ruling system in Iran. Holding our referendum within nearly 50 days after the revolution has had no precedent in any place in the world. Some experts and revolutionary figures would say that the nation's million-strong support for an Islamic ruling system quite clearly proved that there was no need for a referendum. But the great leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, insisted on holding a referendum. This proves that the Imam honestly believed in people and their votes, unlike Western politicians and statesmen who believe in people only as a decorative element in their rule. The Imam said to the people, "This referendum will determine the fate of our nation. This referendum will either drag you to freedom and independence or, like before, to suffocation and affiliation to others. This referendum is what everyone should participate in. You can choose whatever form of government that you wish. You have the right and can write democratic republic, royal regime, or whatever you want on this paper. You are free in this." On April 1, 1979, the Iranian nation unanimously announced their decisive vote and demonstrated their Islamic solidarity and national unity. Thus, they put an end to a long history of tyranny, oppression, and colonialism. Of referendum in Iran led to formation of the Islamic Republic system with the unprecedented vote of over 98.2% of participants in favor of this type of government. This event proved that the free will of the Iranian nation and revived hope in the hearts of the oppressed and downtrodden across the world. The current leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "There is another characteristic in our Islamic Republic Day, that this day is not only the feast of the Iranian people, it can rather be the feast of all those who are Muslims, that is, nearly 1 billion people. They, I mean Muslim nations, have got used to see Islam in the passive position of defense, in the state of isolation. Once a nation stands in the position of attacking domineering powers and attacking incomplete human systems and proclaims a republic on the basis of Islam, this is the source of pride and honor for all Muslim nations. In short, there are various characteristics in the Islamic Republic Day." Dear listeners, the Islamic Republic is a novel and unprecedented form of ruling system. It has seriously challenged the existing forms of government in the West and the East. It is both Islamic and popular, unlike the claimed democratic governments, which have little to do with people's vote and will. Iran has put a new model of government in front of the contemporary man. The establishment of the Islamic Republic system in Iran was followed by both internal and external developments, most of which were not compatible with the goals and policies of colonial and domineering powers. That's why they started all-out enmity with this system from day one of its coming to existence. The Islamic Republic has paid dearly for survival in the ceaseless war of the enemies against the nation. These include the 8-year all-out war that had been imposed on Iran some 18 months after the formation of the Islamic Republic system, assassination of over 17,000 of officials, ordinary people and scientists, cruel sanctions in every field, and creation of obstacles in a very big variety of arenas in which the Iranian nation intends to advance. Now, 43 years into the Islamic Revolution, the Iranian nation has gathered a plethora of experiences and has started marching in the second phase of this revolution, as the leader has put it. The Islamic Republic of Iran stands tall on the summit of Islamic resistance to show the glorious path of freedom and independence to freedom-seeking nations.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the People.
With American students returning to schools in the wake of the COVID pandemic, a new wave of violence is reportedly on the rise across America. Even before the pandemic, incidents of violence, theft, or other crimes were quite common in schools, with 80% of public schools recording that one or more such incidents had occurred, amounting to 1.4 million incidents. Violence is not limited to secondary and middle schools, as even elementary also reported it. And this is all based on what is only officially reported. It'll only make sense that a large number of violent incidents remain unreported, and the amount of violence is much higher.
Violence at U.S. schools.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we'll delve into why the nation is in the grip of a general spike of violence and how it could affect victimization in schools. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic and social unrest are indeed playing a role in violence. Our first guest accompanying us will be John Gehan, an expert in journalism and public administration based out of St. Paul, Minnesota. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Jeremy Kuzmaroff, managing editor at Covert Action Magazine and researcher of modern U.S. history from Tulsa, Oklahoma, to get his take on the issue. Who are to blame and what should be done to address rampant violence in American schools? Who suffers the most and how could it affect society in general as children grow up and leave school? And to find out, stick with us for the rest of the program. Thanks.
The root causes and risk factors behind the rising violence, whether from students to students, students to teachers, or vice versa, are complicated, ranging from access to weapons, media violence, and cyber abuse. The impact of school, community, and family environments and personal alienation also play a role in the spike of violent incidents.
I'm just so emotional because you never think it's going to happen here, and the kids just are all a big part of this community, and it is, I'm so scared for them. And my daughter is safe, but I don't know if all of her friends are safe, and I don't know if my nieces and nephews are safe.
In one word, American culture is to blame for violence, which is not limited to schools, but remains prevalent in streets, bars, and other public venues. So what is the root cause of the problem of violence and misbehavior today in schools in America?
Wow. Well, that's a hard question and a big question. I think, as you know, the United States historically has been a violent country. And the United States has celebrated violence on many levels. You, I'm sure, know that the U.S. is now on another war after four or five or six recent wars. We seem to be in this era where we have permanent, nonstop, worldwide war. So the question is, how does that affect people, young people in this country? And I think it does in a lot of ways. It creates a culture of violence, a culture of war, a culture of solving problems violently.
One could say that fighting among school children is a quite common phenomenon across the world. But what makes the situation unique in America is in part the easy access to guns and the country's broken gun laws. The U.S. history is replete with incidents of tragic and deadly school shootings in which innocent lives have been put to an end.
Therefore, one could argue that preventing violence in American schools is more crucial than elsewhere, Only between 2000 and 2001 and 2019 and 2020, the number of casualties per year as a result of school shootings ranged from 15 to 182. Now, the figure speaks for itself, but how can the status of violence in American schools be assessed, particularly after students remote studying for nearly 2 years' time?
Well, I think a lot of students fell behind. You know, the studies have shown, and I have kids myself, and luckily they went back. They were out of school for a couple months, and very difficult for them. A lot of kids fell behind, you know, whatever the level of schooling. And some kids, you know, they weren't socializing properly, you know, if they were at a formative age. And they came back, and it was, you know, there was a lot of pressure on them, anxiety. They were behind in their schooling, a lot of frustration. Some kids, yeah, fell prey to gangs. You know, you had high school students who were out of school for a long time. As I was saying, they didn't have those, you know, positive mentor that could steer them in a good path, whether a teacher, principal, coach. You know, athletic program can be very important for a lot of kids and keeping them, you know, in school and on a cleaner path. And when those programs were canceled and, you know, people were losing their jobs, some, you know, homes were broken up. So, as I was saying, I think it was a recipe for disaster. And, you know, statistics and news is, you know, we're seeing spikes in violence. And it's on the, you know, nightly news every night. There are incidents, depending on where you live, but certainly in the big cities.
Gun violence is also plaguing schools nationwide. The first half of the 2021-22 school year had the most gun violence in recent history. The U.S. history is tainted with tragic school shootings, some ending fatal, such as the one at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. There were 136 incidents of gunfire on school premises between August 1st and December 31st, 2021. At least 26 people were killed and 96 wounded, making it the highest number of gun incidents and people shot in the five-month period since 2013. And that is just the tip of the iceberg when the whole history of school shootings is taken into account. How should the U.S. authorities address the rise in violence in U.S. schools?
The big answer is stop the war, stop the never-ending wars, reinvest in people's needs, human needs, social needs, health needs, housing needs, to build a healthy culture. Now, whether or not our leaders are going to do that is another question. I have my doubts because our country is largely controlled by the wealthy corporate class that feeds off of violence and feeds off of war. And I suspect that they don't want to invest in human needs.
And now violence prevention efforts could be indeed successful. However, the education system and the general parenting in America have been disappointing at times. Lack of real communication between children and their parents or teachers, as well as absence of clear rules, are among the most immediate issues that need to be addressed.
The American culture means students often have to fight as a means of maintaining their reputations in their schools. Reputation is often seen as a precious commodity that they have to gain with a good show of violence. However, victimization of students will surely lead to more serious concerns as the children grow up. At the end of the day, who is responsible for violence in U.S. schools, whether from students to teachers, or vice versa?
A lot of it is student to student. And some of it is that, yeah, the schools are not well run. You know, they don't have adequate resources. The class sizes may be too big. You know, I mean, it's also important from a young age. You know, if kids, you know, are in a good school system where they're small class sizes, they get the attention they need. Even if they come from a bad home, you know, teacher can have a very positive impact. And, you know, if they develop good study habits and reading skills from at a young age, they'll be prone to succeed in high school. But if they, you know, had very bad school system and the class sizes are too big and they didn't get the attention they needed and they're reading way behind, then they flounder in high school and they may drop out and join gangs, or they may fight, you know, they become frustrated, they don't see a future for themselves, they're failing, and they start fighting or, you know, doing drugs or something.
Violence in schools has various shapes and forms, from bullying, vandalism, gangsterism, indiscipline and intolerance to corporal punishment. There is always one or more victim in violent events. Showing aggressive tendencies appears to be common in American schools.
The violence emerges, grows out of a culture, a U.S. culture that does not respect people's humanity. Teachers, for the most part, are hardworking people who care about the students and who are doing their best to deliver an education to the students. Students, to some extent, are, you know, young people are young people, and they need to be shaped and controlled and given direction. And I think that's what the teachers are trying to do. But I'm very hesitant to lay the blame on either students or teachers.
For serious violence, secondary and middle schools report the same incident of serious violence at 29%, while 14% of elementary schools have reported at least one serious incident. One of the rather crucial factors generally raising the amount of violence in the country is witnessing violence in the media and video games. So what role does the promotion of violence in American culture, from video games to Hollywood, play in the rise of misbehavior in American schools?
The culture, you can think of the culture as, you know, and on an international level, war and aggression, but certainly at a national level, in sports, in culture, video games, films, Hollywood films, television, all of those platforms celebrate violence. They all illustrate that violence is a solution to problems. And I think the culture, kind of from the lower level to the higher level, all of that culture certainly is responsible for some of the problems that young people have.
Experiencing violence at home and the community means children resort to it more readily. Therefore, kids choose to fight easily in retaliation for teasing or unprovoked assaults. Disagreements turn into violent struggles, and violence becomes the go-to method to settle dominance disputes. Fights usually occur when people don't talk about their problems and their friends are feeding them the wrong information. Fights also occur because of misunderstandings and gossip, as children are not taught to tend towards talking logically in order to settle disputes. The role of the teachers and parents is crucial, but the education system should also take matters into its hands and focus on the issue more closely. What should parents do to lessen their children's violence in schools? And what could the U.S. education system do?
Every parent is responsible to try and raise his child with positive values. Unfortunately, we see a lot of broken homes. I mean, one, you know, thing in like a lot of, as you were saying, with the racial profiling, you have a lot of communities, you know, maybe more black or minority communities, where a huge number of the men are locked up because of the war on drugs. You know, the racial profiling, and, you know, they were targeted. And they were given long, long sentences, so they're in jail. They can't help in raising their kids. They're not there for the kids. Then, you know, single mothers could be overwhelmed. So, I mean, I think the U.S. government should end the war on drugs. And, you know, a lot of politicians were very hypocritical in promoting this kind of family value, especially conservatives claimed to be for family values. And yet they were supporting the lockup of so many men under the war on drugs. So they couldn't be there help raise their kids in a good way. So,
exposure to youth violence and school violence can lead to a wide array of negative health behaviors and outcomes. Now, as students grow up and leave school, they may resort to alcohol and drug use or suicide or experience depression, anxiety, and many other psychological problems.
Yeah, what do parents do? I think that's a question that just about every parent is asking. How can I protect my children? How can I raise my child to be healthy? And how can I teach my children to understand what the messages they're getting in the world? I don't think anybody has an answer to that. What can parents do? Parents can try to explain the world, explain why things are happening. That's a good start. But of course, what parents think and the amount of information that parents have is dependent again on this mass culture.
Now, teachers themselves could also be victimized by violence at schools. Witnessing violence often could make a teacher numb to this phenomena. They may also suffer from everyday experiences of seeing violence, especially as students grow up to be more capable of inflicting harm or damage.
An integrated approach is needed to address violence in schools today. Educators, parents, and learners must work together to tackle causes of violence on a daily basis. The U.S. education system should lead the effort to educate everyone in how to lessen violence in schools. Policymaking is also key in reduction of violence across the nation by restricting the children's access to extremely violent content. Video games or TV shows and the online content that kids have access to should be stripped of overly violent scenes. With less exposure to such content, as well as educating kids about communication, officials could expect to see less violence not only in U.S. schools, but also in the streets.
And now it's time we check in with Abbas Montarim to get his take on this week's issue.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. Today on the show, we will take a look at the colonial violence of the education system in America, the genocidal practice of chattel slavery that resulted in black people being banned to read and write. While these white kids was going to school, slave owners would literally lynch black people if they knew how to read. So if black people who were on the plantation and was enslaved, if they wanted to learn how to read and write, they literally had to do so in secrecy to avoid being lynched or whipped. But despite all odds, black folks on the plantation began to read and write. And this helped play a pivotal role in the emancipation from the slave plantation. Revolutionary writings such as David Walker's The Appeal had advocated for the abolishment of slavery. His writings was literally smuggled onto plantations and given to black people who were enslaved. Walker, he called on people who were enslaved to revolt against their masters. In his book, he said, quote, "They want us for their slaves and think nothing of murdering us. Therefore, if there was an attempt made by us, kill or be killed." He also said, quote, "And believe this, that it is no more harm for you to kill a man who is trying to kill you than it is for you to take a drink of water when thirsty." The book is reported to have led to Nat Turner's famous rebellion on the plantation, and it sparked fear into these slave owners, and it was clear that revolutionary knowledge would have emancipatory potential. As slavery was abolished, black people, they began to have more access to education. Well, the first HBCU, Cheney University, was founded pre the Civil War in the North in Pennsylvania. Most HBCUs began to be established post the Civil War to provide education for Black people. Many of these new HBCUs that were developed were either by former slave owners or white missionaries. Even the first HBCU, Cheney University, it was founded by Richard Humphrey, who was a Quaker and literally got all his wealth from slavery. Humphrey decided to build a school for Black people after race riots, so it literally can be concluded that he did this to try and stop rebellions in the streets. It wasn't some good old intentions of giving education to Black people. He was only giving education to Black people to stop race riots, to stop rebellions that were happening in the streets. Even the famous Howard University was founded by a white general in the army, and Howard today has faced protests by students for poor living conditions and poor classroom conditions, and professors that are currently threatening to go on strike due to bad working conditions. While HBCUs, they have played a pivotal role in educating our people, we must also recognize that many of them, they are designed to indoctrinate Black people into buying into this American capitalist system. As the civil rights movement afforded Black people, quote unquote, more rights, these white-only schools, they began to become integrated. And in the North and in the West Coast, as Black folks fled the South, they began integrating schools that were white-only. One of these places and one of these schools that began to get integrated was in Oakland. As the civil rights movement afforded Black people more rights, white-only schools began to become more integrated. And in the North and West Coast, as Black folks fled their racist Jim Crow South, they began integrating schools that were white only. One of the places schools began to be integrated in is in Oakland. But these schools, they still use racist disciplinary codes, created school police departments to police Black students, and they were also, these white kids, they was also attacking Black classmates who were integrating into these schools. This led to Huey Newton, who was the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, to create a gang called the Brotherhood to stop the violence that white students was enacting onto Black students. This experience is a major reason why the Black Panther Party's fifth point of their 10-point program was, quote, "We want education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches us our true history and role in the present day society." And today, it is very clear that that message, it still rings true. The school system is rooted in American apartheid. Parents are arrested through racist truancy laws. Black girls are literally dragged by racist cops within the classroom. Black students are suspended at a higher rate than whites. Schools are still segregated. Whites go to college more than Black people. And the list, it literally goes on and on. And all of this is rooted in the legacy of slavery. It's clear that these schools, they aren't ours. And our people still aren't getting a true education. But this is literally what the system is all about. It's about indoctrination, not about liberatory education. And that's what we have to have, is liberatory education that will free us from Euro-American colonial control. This is Power to the People.
And that was our show, everyone. Thank you for watching, and please tune in next week for another episode of We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and it's goodbye.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.